From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College.
This is
War News Radio.
War News Radio. I'm Vanessa Meng. Last week, we introduced the first in a series of interviews with Central American migrants. These come to us from reporter Liliana Frankel, who spent this summer living and working at a migrant shelter in Mexico. We have a second installment of that series this week. First, though, we turn our attention to the other side of the globe. In Hong Kong last September, protests broke out in response to proposed changes to the electoral system. We first covered the Hong Kong protests in our October 2014 show, Voices of Discontent. In the years since then, the movement ended and Hong Kong faded from the U.S. media's radar. So what's happened in Hong Kong this year, in the aftermath of the protests? Reporter Jacob Demery and Catherine Kwok fill us in.
What do you picture when you think of Hong Kong's Occupy movement? Do you recall images of protesters shielding themselves with umbrellas? Or the tent villages set up on roads and highways? If your mind is drawing a blank, here's what you need to know. Hong Kong citizens occupied parts of the city for 79 days last year, demanding democratic elections for the chief executive position. Since 1997, an election committee has monopolized the process, meaning the average citizen cannot vote. So, what triggered the movement? China handed down a proposal last August, saying that Hong Kong could hold open elections, but only if the candidates were chosen by a select committee. And many Hong Kong citizens were worried that the committee would filter out candidates that are critical of China and the city's elites. In response to what they saw as an undemocratic proposal, high school and college students boycotted class. Some of them even stormed the central government offices, and they were met with batons and pepper spray. From there, thousands of Hong Kong citizens took to the street to support the student protesters. When we reported on the movement last November, both student protesters and pan-democratic legislators expressed a need for leadership and consensus. They were looking to channel the protest momentum into substantial changes. But a little more than a month later, the demonstrations fizzled away anticlimactically. Many people believe that the lack of energy and direction towards the end was key to the Occupy movement's quiet end. As the police cleared away the tent villages, protesters went back to their homes, offices, and classrooms. In the end, they weren't able to negotiate and change the Chinese election framework. But despite the lack of tangible progress, the movement showed Hong Kong people's drive to defend their political rights. Benny Tai, one of the organizers, even said the protest was a political awakening of a generation. While some were inspired by the crowds that participated in mass civil disobedience, the end of the Occupy movement also discouraged a lot of hopeful Hong Kongers. They saw the protest's anticlimactical end as further evidence that nothing could change China's mind about democratic reform, and they believe that the Chinese proposal handed down last August was here to stay. So, it would be in Hong Kong's best interest to just accept China's offer. In public polls conducted this June, around half of the respondents believed that the city's lawmakers should pass the Chinese proposal, and the other half believed that Hong Kong should not accept a limited democracy. This split in public opinion was placed in the spotlight, especially leading up to the city's political reform this summer. The Legislative Council was set to vote on a package that included a number of different policy revisions. One of those proposed changes was China's new framework for the chief executive elections. To everyone's surprise, pro-China lawmakers walked out of the session in a failed attempt to postpone the meeting. This left a pan-democratic majority in the council chambers, and 28 out of the remaining 37 lawmakers voted against the bill. Many protesters opposing the proposal were excited with the outcome, but this celebratory mood was short-lived. Chinese Deputy Secretary General Li Fei declared on September 1st that there will be no chance of open nominations for the 2017 chief executive elections. Essentially, he made the point that the Chinese proposal for elections is here to stay. So, how are the protesters responding to China's firm stance? And winding back, what has happened to them since the end of the Occupy movement? Most of the student protesters have returned to school, but that doesn't mean the end of their involvement in politics. Student leader Nathan Law thinks, quote, everyone is preparing, waiting for the right reasons to take the streets again. But they face significant challenges from the government. In August, Law and a fellow student activist, Joshua Wong, were charged with unlawful assembly and incitement. Many Hong Kong citizens spoke up against these charges, claiming that the government is attempting to silence political activism. On top of this, university faculty members are also facing negative consequences for their involvement in the movement. For example, Johan Chan, former dean of the Faculty of Law at the University of Hong Kong, was denied appointment to the administrative position due to a supposed connection to the movement. Last Monday, protesters gathered in front of the central government offices to commemorate the Occupy movement's one-year anniversary. Organizer Benny Tai said that he can imagine if the central government continues to deny Hong Kong people genuine democracy, the people of Hong Kong will come out again.
That piece was produced by Catherine Kwok, Jacob Demree, and myself. Catherine reported on the Hong Kong Occupy movement for Radio Television Hong Kong this summer. You can find the link to those stories on our website, warnewsradio.org. Reporter Liliana Frankel spent this summer at Albergue Hermanos en El Camino, a migrant shelter in Ixtepec, Oaxaca. While she was there, she got to know some of the people passing through. We're sharing a few of her conversations here to get a closer look at the Central American migrant crisis. Last week, we heard the story of Lisandra Lopez, a Honduran veteran of the Iraq War. This week, an interview with Alex, a Honduran man who grew up in Canada, was deported and is now risking his life to return.
Alex is an American in the continental sense. He was born in Honduras, grew up in Canada, and has also lived in the United States. He's traversed Guatemala and Mexico multiple times. He used to dream of getting Canadian citizenship so that he could officially belong to the land where he was raised, but that dream ended 8 years ago when he was deported. Since then, Alex has come to relate to the places he lives in less in terms of his own heart connection to them, and more in terms of the kinds of opportunities that they offer. When I met him, he was attempting to cross Mexico and enter the United States for the second time. This is a hard story, a graphic story. I encourage you to listen to it, remembering that it's not so far away, and that its protagonist is someone you may have already overlapped with. Here's Alex.
It's very difficult to walk this road, especially for people who have already been in a country like Canada or the United States, who have grown up in a country with totally different culture, different educational system, different ways of thinking, different kinds of social instability. For people who haven't grown up in their native countries, the road is very hard.
When Alex was a child, he and his mother flew to Montreal with visas as legal immigrants. He learned French in school and adapted quickly to his new environment. He didn't have much of a choice.
In Canada, there are not very many Hispanic people, really only a few, and there are even fewer Hispanic people specifically from Honduras.
However, Alex maintained a long view of the anti-immigrant sentiment he occasionally encountered in French Canada, remembering that after all, Montreal stood on land wrested from the Native Americans. He enjoyed his job as a chef and has fond memories of taking his girlfriend fishing in a river near his home. Besides, his other problems were more immediate.
When I was a young man, I was very hard to deal with, very rebellious. So my mother always told me to behave myself. But I was a hardhead and went around doing things that I didn't have to do. I lacked respect for the authorities. I had a lot of problems.
Eventually, Alex would bump up against the limits of his permanent residency in Canada. In Quebec, any non-citizen brought to court for a crime whose punishment might involve 6 or more months of jail time also runs the risk of deportation. However, not all immigrants tried in criminal courts are deported, and many are given stays or a chance to rehabilitate. The court told Alex that he could remain in Canada if his behavior shaped up. But he violated the terms of his probation, and at the age of 27, after living most of his life outside of Central America, he found himself once again in Honduras. That was 8 years ago now.
When I arrived to Honduras, I was already a grown man, an adult. And believe me, when I arrived, I got scared. Scared simply because I was in a country where I hadn't grown up, where the culture, the food, and most importantly, the security concerns were totally different.
Alex didn't want to stay in Honduras, but he also lacked the resources to legally return to Quebec. So he decided to partner up with his cousin and attempt a journey to the United States. Although the two lost track of one another in Mexico, Alex made it safely across the border, but he was eventually deported back to Honduras after a policeman cited him for driving without a license in Arkansas. Alex had no choice but to return again to Central America, where, in his absence, the situation had only become more militarized, more violent, and to him, more foreign-feeling.
There are a lot of street gangs. I couldn't bear to spend more than 2 months there.
For a Central American, deciding to travel north through Mexico is a potentially life-threatening choice. Because migrants journey undocumented, they have few legal resources within Mexico, which is known even to its own citizens as a place where the powerful can act with impunity. Many migrants have to carry large sums of cash with them to pay their ways, and others carry the phone numbers of the relatives who fund their journeys.
It's a big adventure, but dangerous too, you know?
Last summer, the United States and Mexico began working together to transpose military-style North American border enforcement strategies to the South. Plan Frontera Sur, as the initiative is known, is meant to prevent Central American migrants from ever reaching the U.S. border by increasing the rate of their deportations from Mexico. Indeed, 52% more Central American migrants have been deported from Mexico in the last year than in the year previous. But this dubious gain comes with its own heavy price. In the state of Oaxaca, where Alex and I met, the crimes reported by migrants in this period also increased by 97%. This is likely because the decentralization of enforcement efforts has pushed migrants off their traditional beaten paths and, during law enforcement raids, scattered large groups who otherwise might have found safety in numbers. Alex arrived to Mexico's southern border hyper-aware of the need for caution. He spent 7 months working in Benemérito de las Américas, Chiapas, a border town, and trying to inform himself about the dangers of the road. Eventually, he connected with another Honduran man who believed that the safest way north was on public transport. The two set off together, but soon Alex had run out of money. He had little choice but to split up with his travel partner and look for a place to catch the train.
I waited for the train for 4 days. On the fourth day, while I was waiting, the night fell, and out of it sprung three thieves. I began to defend myself, striking out at the thieves, and thank God they weren't armed. If they had been, something truly terrible might have happened to me. So then I ran away, and they left as well. And I remember hiding under a tree, and the train passed me by. But I didn't know where that train was going, so I left running after it, since it was dark by that point, and I followed the train trying to catch it. It was nighttime, so I could see nothing and no one. So, we arrived at a station stop called Corazones, and I asked a worker where the train was going. He told me, it goes to Arriaga. So, I had actually gone back the way I'd came.
Now, Alex had a lot of backtracking to do. He met a migrant couple, also from Honduras, and spent several days traveling northward with them. One day, they walked together in the sun for 12 hours straight. Several days later, while riding the train, they lost each other at a migration checkpoint. As the train slowed to a stop, all the people hitching a ride got down and began to flee in different directions. The couple ran one way, and Alex another. At the end of the raid, although Alex had been separated from his original companions, he and the other escaped migrants decided that they would accompany one another on the 7-kilometer walk to the next town. Kind Mexicans shared food with them, and the group pooled a few pesos together so that they could pass around some soda. They made their camp near the train tracks and planned to leave together the next morning. But when they awoke, it was to another raid by migration officials.
Canadian law enforcement is respectful. Honduran law enforcement will grab you as you're walking down the street. And if they want to, they'll beat you and they'll rob you. In Latin America, it's normal. The Mexican police have stopped me and beaten me and asked for all my money. In Canada, that wouldn't happen.
This time, Alex was lucky. He escaped from the raid undetained and mostly unscathed, but he was also now completely alone. This is where his testimony begins.
I was alone and started on my way, with a water bottle, my backpack. But before that, I had begged for money, like 300 pesos. I had some money, water, my backpack, my papers, and I headed alone. Many people say that it was 3 hours walking, but it was more than 3 hours. To get to Juchitán, it ended up being 9 hours. 9 hours in the sun and extreme heat. I finished my water and had to steal from wells on the ranches that I had passed. I decided to rest before getting to Juchitán. There was a street that I had gone on and a mountain, and I was too tired to go on. I decided to rest there for the night. I was half asleep when 13 people that I didn't know arrived. When they arrived, they grabbed my legs. I thought that they were from migration because you could see the train tracks. That's why I thought they were from migration. I was face down and they grabbed my legs so I wouldn't run, but they weren't migration because they put a bag on my head. And at that point, I got scared. I panicked. What was happening? Because just as I moved my head, I saw three hooded men. I thought this wasn't migration. They were thieves. They looked at me and picked me up and tied my hands. And we walked and they brought me onto a truck. The drive was 45 minutes long. They brought me in the car. When you walk along the rails, you see the streets where the cars pass, so the people driving can see that you are walking. They see you're a migrant walking along the rails. They brought me. I was tired. My feet were tired. And when they asked me where the other migrants were, I said, "What migrants? I was coming alone." So many people passed by the rails, but I was alone. They began to hit my head and punch my face. I couldn't see because I had the bag on my face, so I was covered. They hit me and hit me, and they said they were going to kill me. They asked for the phone number of my family, and I said that I didn't have family, that I was alone. Organized crime always thinks people have family in the US, or they think that we have a lot of money. 45 minutes later, they took me from the car, and we arrived at a house, and they put me in a room. I was alone there. They began to torture me, to hit me. They kicked me, threw me into the ground, and they said that they were the Zetas. When I heard that, I thought that they were going to kill me. Luckily, God is great. They might have not been the Zetas, because if they were, they would have definitely killed me. That was the situation. They brought me to that place. I'm pretty sure that it was a house, but in this house there wasn't a floor, which I know because they had taken off my shoes and I was barefoot. They had taken my backpack already, and all my documents and my little bit of money. When they came to check on me, they pulled the bag on my head up to cover just half of my face, so that I could breathe through my nose and mouth, and there it would stay for almost 2 days, always over my eyes. I was tied up. They gave me water, but nothing more. Just water, so that I wouldn't die or suffocate inside the bag. They left me for a while. Then I would listen for the door opening again, and then more beatings, more hitting, saying that if I didn't give them a phone number, they were going to kill me. They used a very Mexican idiom to tell me they were going to fuck me up. I felt scared and soft. I couldn't get my words out. I don't have family. I'm alone here in Mexico. I'm looking for work. But like fools, they just wanted the phone number, and they kept threatening me about it. That's how the time passed. Eventually, they put a pistol in my mouth. It was more to scare me than anything else. And I mean, it worked. I thought, this is where I'm going to die. So they left me there. And when they left, even though my eyes were always covered, I heard screaming. Maybe other people that they were torturing. And I could hear that they were talking on the phone, and then more screaming. And I thought, those people that they're torturing must be on the phone with their families, so that they would send money. I was more afraid than ever. I'm alone, I said to myself. Time passed and passed. They came again. Now they wanted to speak nicely to me, but hypocritically. If I gave them a number, they weren't going to do anything to me. Everything was going to be fine. They were going to help me. I told them, well, I don't have a number. I'm traveling alone. I didn't come with anyone. They asked me over and over, where are you going? And I said, I'm going to the capital. I want to get a job. I heard that more people were coming in, and they beat me over the head. Then they left me there. and the first guy who'd been talking to me told me that I had to give him the phone number, and if not, they would fuck me up. But no, they didn't get any numbers out of me. They just beat me up. About 6 hours passed, and then they brought me to the car, and I heard one of them say, "Kill that guy. Kill him and put his body on the road." I was scared. I said to myself, they're going to take me and they're going to kill me. Well, they took me. When we arrived to the spot that they took me down from the car, they told me to get down and I felt iron on my head, a pistol, I believe. But no, thank God, I'd been untied. My mouth was open. I was trembling. I said, shit, they're going to kill me, these people. There wasn't anyone nearby. They took the bag off my head and told me not to move. I was there almost half an hour, like this, on the ground. But only 3 or so minutes after they took off the bag on my head, I heard a car driving off. Because I was so afraid, I said to myself, if I move, they're gonna shoot me. But no, thank God. I turned around and I didn't see anyone, just the mountains. There I was, without my shoes, my backpack, my money, nothing.
It was over. Shaken, Alex began to walk. Shortly, he encountered a group of people on the train bridge, some of whom were Honduran migrants. But Alex felt wary of trusting in strangers, any strangers, after what he had just survived. The group shared their water with him, and after some careful observing, Alex decided to camp with them for the night. The next day, they moved on to Ixtepec and the migrant shelter. Noticing that Alex traveled barefoot, one of his new friends bought him a bus ticket. He didn't even have 20 pesos, less than $2, to pay the fare. When we recorded this interview in August, Alex had been staying in Albergue Hermanos en el Camino for 15 days already, and he was applying for his Mexican refugee paperwork. It was a process that at first he'd been reluctant to undertake.
Why should I? Why do you want me to make a denouncement? Everyone in law enforcement is just the same.
But after a few days in the shelter and some conversations with staff, Alex would change his mind. Several months later, he would be granted his Mexican refugee status. Just this week, Alex left Albergue Hermanos en el Camino for the city of Puebla. He's there now looking for work. I wonder what Alex will tell the new people he meets about the things he survived in Mexico. It's not easy to explain torture or to know how to respond to it. My own natural instinct was to distance myself. After all, most of the narratives of torture we receive in the news can neatly achieve a distancing effect by dramatizing the process or by exoticizing its victims. But Alex's story feels too close.
I suffered a lot for the simple fact that I didn't behave myself. It's a very difficult tragedy. It leaves something very ugly in your mind. It's a very horrible experience to know that there's this kind of cruelty in people, this kind of evil.
Alex never told me exactly what he'd done to be deported from Canada, but to me, it seems obvious that the stakes of his exile were higher than anyone could have fairly anticipated. Alex has been in limbo between various societies which don't quite accept him ever since he left home. Because of his disidentification with Honduras, where he supposedly should belong, he became the victim of a terrible abuse of human rights.
But it's hard, you know? Because to give anything your all implies not losing hope. You have to fight, you know? In life, you always have to fight. It is good to learn in life, to learn from different places and people and countries. Every country has their own way of living, culture, and way of thinking. Unfortunately, although my country is beautiful, very beautiful, the people and the government don't know how to live in harmony and peace. A lot of people here in Mexico ask us why we come. I'll explain to you and you'll understand, but you're not going to feel it like I felt it. In my country, I lived that reality in meat and bone. And if my country were not as it is, I would be there. I wouldn't chance these dangerous roads. I wouldn't risk my life.
For War News Radio, I'm Liliana Frankel.
That piece was produced by Liliana Frankel and Tyler Welsh. Production assistance from Ian Grant and Kathleen Escoto. We also produced the Spanish version of this piece. You can find that, and the first story in this series, on our website. Our show was produced this week by Rachel Young with the help of Leo Elliott and Amber Sheth. War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College. Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about our program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's warnewsradio.org. You can follow us on Facebook or Twitter to keep up with us between shows and let us know what you think. I'm Vanessa Meng. We'll be back next time. Thanks for listening.